Welcome back everyone to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, big show for you, including three guests. That's about as many as we can fit without the control room getting really frustrated with me. So in just a little bit, Jordan Ewell is gonna be joining the show once again to break down some of the big news of the day. We've got a congressional candidate. We've got an author with a really funny, awesome book that we're gonna break down. We've got AOC. Not on the show, unfortunately. We're still trying to do that. But she is going to be talked about on the show to close it out. AOC has really taken a hands-off approach to the Democratic primary for the most part. Not today, okay? She has harsh words for one of the primary contenders for their harsh words for other primary contenders. So that should be a lot of fun. But before we get to all of that, and that is a lot to get to, we're gonna start off with an interesting development in some of what protected Donald Trump back during the 2016 election. So we're gonna be starting there. We all know that the National Enquirer and their parent company, AMI, were instrumental in, at least to some extent, some influence on Donald Trump getting elected, because in the months leading up to the election, they did what's called catch and kill, which I was joking earlier, sounds really dramatic. It turns out it's just paying people for their story and then they're not actually publishing it. It's like anti-media, but they're technically a media company, so it's interesting how that works out. Basically, if there is a damaging story that could hurt someone they like, someone that, for instance, like Donald Trump, they've had connections with for a couple decades, they pay off the person who has the story, and then they take the exclusive rights to the story and they don't actually distribute it. So we all know that, but there's more information coming out about this practice and what the National Enquirer was getting up to. And it's coming out thanks to, as is almost always the case in the past few years, the great investigative work of Ronan Farrow, whose upcoming book, Catch and Kill, which is either out today or tomorrow, documents this process and other parts of Farrow's investigation. So let's talk about some of what AMI did to protect Donald Trump. During the first week of November 2016, the book, Catch and Kill, alleges that Dylan Howard, who was then editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer, ordered a staff member to get everything out of the safe and that, quote, we need to get a shredder down here. So it's not like they're doing a reboot of the Ninja Turtles. That's what you do to protect a rich, influential person. So always a good sign when you have a bunch of documents revealing what a person's true character is, and you feel like the only way they can get into elected office is if you rip it up in a tiny little shred. So they decided to do that. Now, what was the context for this order? His order came the same day a reporter for the Wall Street Journal had called the Enquirer to ask for comment on a story about how AMI, which owns the National Enquirer, had paid $150,000 to former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who said she'd had an affair with Trump to keep her quiet right before the election. The Enquirer never published her story. That obviously would have been a big story. Now, we can debate whether, you know, a candidate having had an affair should matter for someone's vote. I think if you don't think it should matter, that is a perfectly justified position to have. But supposedly Trump supporters care about this sort of thing. They care about the moral character, the moral fiber of a candidate. And Donald Trump is a guy who has neither morals nor a consumption of fiber. And so that might have mattered to some of them. But to be fair, in the case of Donald Trump, I mean, we had so much information about the horrible things that he had done and the horrible things he had said. I think that he was relatively well insulated from this sort of story hurting him in comparison to other people. I mean, if this came out about, like, I don't know, I was gonna say Buttigieg or Booker, that would be a big story. With Donald Trump, probably less so. But they were still worried about it, so worried that they were willing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get these stories. So worried that even once they had them, they feared that the hard copies would ever get out, and so they needed to be destroyed. And so they had a process, and like what I just said, it gets progressively more defensive. When the material that they collected, and this is over the period of literally years, came to the AMI headquarters, it was first put into a small safe. Then, as the scandal around the magazine's close relationship with Trump deepened, it was placed into a bigger safe in the office of AMI's head of human resources, Daniel Rotstein. It's so corrupt, his name's got rotten. But anyway, so they put it in a safe, but that safe isn't secure enough because inside of AMI, they know, and the sources that Ronan Farrow talked to make pretty clear, they feared that the potential monetary value of these stories or the damage that they could do to Trump would be such that they were afraid that internally some of this documentation might be stolen and later distributed. And so that initial safe wasn't secure enough. They needed to move it to another one. And now let's talk about the consequences of this. How much did they have? What might have come if they hadn't done this? Well, Farrow quotes one former Inquirer journalist, Jerry George, who estimates that Pecker was the leader at that point, quote, killed perhaps 10 fully reported stories about Trump and nixed many more potential leads during George's 28 years at the Inquirer. So look, the part of this that concerns us is obviously most about the election, because that's what we know so far, and it seems like it might have swayed a percentage point or something like that. But this goes back literally decades. I mean, back before he'd run for president. Now, there had been previous periods over the past few decades where Trump talked about potentially running for president. There was even once or twice where he sort of got involved in it. He likes to rewrite history, but that did happen. And so he already had this shield prepared for himself as far back as you want to go. But it was most important in this particular case. And the idea that there were 10 fully reported stories. So Karen McDougal, that's one. That could have been enough. Now imagine all of these others. And there were other potential stories too, like Stormy Daniels, sort of different situation. But again, catch and kill was done, this time by Michael Cohen, who is, you know, serving jail time for that right now. And by the way, how amazing is it that of all of what we're revealing here, Michael Cohen's the only person who paid any price, really. He's going to jail. Donald Trump is happily in office, might finish his first term, hell, might get a second one. He's doing just fine. All these people at AMI and the National Enquirer, they participated in the Mueller investigation to the extent that you can really be helpful after shredding all of the evidence that they presumably want from you. And so they're protected from prosecution. Isn't it an amazing deal that they were able to work out there? And now this new information is coming out, and AMI has put out a statement saying, Mr. Farrow's narrative is driven by unsubstantiated allegations from questionable sources. And while these stories may be dramatic, they're completely untrue, which is my favorite statement for a couple of different reasons. First of all, AMI has already had to backtrack on their prior statements that they had not done things like this to protect Donald Trump. Turned out those weren't true. But also, how beautiful is it that the National Enquirer, or the people who, you know, make the National Enquirer, are talking about other people using unsubstantiated allegations from questionable sources that are dramatic but not untrue, or but not true. That's their entire business model. They've profited very well for literally years off of doing that sort of thing. In the case of Ronan Farrow, of all the journalists, he seems to do a pretty good job of making sure that what he is saying is true. We'll find out. I mean, the book is gonna come out. It is going to be torn to pieces. And if anything is inaccurate, you can be sure that you'll hear about it, perhaps with court cases or something like that. But as of right now, it shows that the National Enquirer and AMI went to even further lengths than we knew. Immediate lengths, almost operating like something like a war room for the Trump campaign to make sure that you never found out who he actually was. It's a sort of protection that you or I could never hope to get. But when you're rich and when you're well connected, you get this sort of protection. And you might even get an office based on it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Jordan Ewell's gonna join us. We're gonna talk about some of the big news of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
A originally, Facebook was a great place to go to poke your friends, if you remember that, and take a look at cat photos. More recently, it's been an amazing place to find really awesome grade A misinformation about politics. Misinformation so wrong and so consequential and so widespread that it could hypothetically influence certain elections. So considering all of that, how is Zuckerberg thinking about the future of Facebook and news? Is he taking this seriously? Well, we have an update. And it's worrying. On Monday afternoon, hashtag delete Facebook made a comeback as a Twitter trend after it was revealed that Facebook head Mark Zuckerberg had held informal meetings and off the record dinners with conservative journalists, commenters, and at least one Republican congressman in a political article, including Tucker Carlson and Lindsey Graham. These are people with at best a tenuous connection to reality, and those are the ones that are getting secret behind closed doors access to Mark Zuckerberg. According to Politico, the dinners began in July and are apparently Zuckerberg's attempt at circumventing the notion that Facebook is biased against conservatives. You know, the sort of notion that's been spread by people like Lindsey Graham and Tucker Carlson, sort of self-interested there. Anyway, what is going to happen based on this? What effect might this have on the 2020 election? Joining us now to break it down, Jordan Ewell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Great to have you here. So Zuckerberg's meeting with Tucker Carlson and other conservatives. What do you make of this? How worried should we be?
So there's a lot of context here for these Facebook, like Mark Zuckerberg, right-wing figure meetings. So as you mentioned in your intro, Facebook has been subject to a lot of criticism from the right. None of it well-founded, that Facebook is censoring conservative posts and limiting their reach, which again, completely unfounded. At Media Matters, we've done a ton of studies about this so-called conservative bias and have found no causal evidence to show that they are discriminating against Republican pages and conservative pages more than liberal pages. So while this is happening, he's secretly meeting with these right-wing figures. It's a way for them to game the refs. Additionally, Facebook is also like the target for a lot of discussions regarding DOJ enforcement actions, antitrust challenges, you know, just ultimately breaking up Facebook. So he has a business interest in appealing to these right-wing figures, people like Tucker Carlson, who have Trump's ear and have been a frequent critic of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. So to win these people over is a business move.
You know, I'm going to jump ahead to this because you brought it up there. So there have been a number of candidates who have implied that Facebook reform needs to come to social media companies, including Facebook. Bernie Sanders is a great example of that. But more recently, he had this little back and forth with Elizabeth Warren. So she didn't like that he was allowing Trump to blatantly lie in his campaign advertisements. Facebook, their response has basically been, what are you going to do? He's a politician, he gets to lie, even if it changes, you know, the course of the election. And so she says effectively that there needs to be significant reform. If she were to become president, Zuckerberg obviously has a business interest in stopping that. Facebook is incredibly influential. How crazy is it to think that were she to be the nominee, he might theoretically change his approach to this sort of thing during the election based on his fears of what might happen to Facebook?
Oh boy. I mean, you heard the leaked audio. I think we've talked about it before. A couple weeks ago, it was reported that Mark Zuckerberg at a meeting among staff called a progressive presidency, and the example he gave was Elizabeth Warren. He called a progressive presidency an existential threat to Facebook. So again, I mean, you have a financial incentive to undermine these people, to cozy up to the right, to protect his business interests, and ultimately protect the financial interests of his investors. Now, that's troubling because also at the same time, when you have a right-wing sphere that you need to appeal to, and they're also gaming the refs and trying to get their pages more likes, more views, more shares, et cetera. At the same time, he also had a Republican group led by former Senator John Kyle audit these claims to find conservative bias. So across the board, you have this deference to right-wing actors acting in bad faith on what is a serious issue. When you have one of the most used platforms influencing elections, and you have misinformation and blatant lies being spread by a presidential candidate, and you're not doing anything because you need their approval to protect your business, that's a clear conflict of interest.
100%. And you know, we're now used to, and Media Matters has done a great job of documenting that the right wing is just going to complain and lie about the supposed discrimination that they face because they're whiners. We can expect that, but the companies actually like bowing down before that and agreeing to it, that distresses me. But I want to move on to another topic because there's a few other things I want to get to. You might have seen the video came out a couple days ago. It's been out for like a year, but this video of Donald Trump effectively murdering media figures and politicians that he's not a fan of, including, by the way, TYT was one of those that was murdered in the video. Now, you might think this looks bad for Trump and is a threat to those media figures, but Republican analyst Rick Tyler was brought on to MSNBC to make the case that, no, actually Trump is the victim here.
People can make all kinds of things and put them online, and it has nothing to do with the president. But this was played at Doral property by Trump supporters. So, I mean, just someone's maniacally stupid to put something out there. I mean, it's just a horrific, very graphic video of the president, you know, supposedly taking on the media and his political enemies. It just has no place in the political.
Violently taking out.
Well, yeah, and you know what? I hate to say this, and I contemplate not saying it, but I'm going to say it. This video endangers Donald Trump more than anybody else because there are crazy people out there, and people will watch something like this and think that by not denouncing it, the president actually supports violence. And that's a dangerous thing. I know the Secret Service is not crazy about these kinds of things, and this is why, because it provokes violence.
Okay, so the true victim here is Donald Trump. Jordan, your thoughts?
I mean, that's just absolutely ludicrous. There's nothing apparently that Republicans won't defend. I mean, the bar is on the floor, and they're somehow finding a way to go underneath it. This was, you know, pretty easy thing to criticize and dismiss and you know, condemn. But there's here we are in a situation where yet again Republicans are literally going to defend anything that is you know, negative and connected to Trump in any capacity. This was a purely grotesque video. And as you said, TYT's logo was in there. There was logos from tons of other reputable news organizations, and they're just depicted as Trump slaughtering them. This is really alarming because also Caesar Sayoc, the pro-Trump mail bomber, his target list had a lot of overlap with the people featured and organizations featured in this video. This is extremely troubling. And it isn't just purely fictional because this has happened already.
Yeah.
We have instances of the Trump supporters lashing out at the media, trying to hurt them, trying to bomb them. And here we have someone glamorizing it. It's really disgusting.
You know, I'm curious on your thoughts on strategy when somebody like this happens. So this video comes out, it's big news Sunday night. And I know there was a big disagreement. A lot of people wondering, do we need to directly address this, potentially even showing it to reveal how horrendous this sort of thing is? Or is that doing the work of the propagandist who made this video in the first place? What do you think about this disagreement?
I really do. I hate to both sides, but I really do see both sides of the argument here. I personally did not share it because I just didn't really feel the need to. I didn't think people needed to see it that night. A lot of people clearly expressed an intent not to see it, and I wanted to be mindful of that. So graphic things like that, I try not to share. But you know, if it's just any other instance, I think there is some value in documenting it, showing it to people, presenting it. Like, this is what they're watching at these conservative conferences, these well-attended conservative conferences where, you know, high-profile right-wing figures are attending and speaking and keynoting. This is the media that they're showing at these conferences. Yeah. So there is value in talking about it that way.
Yeah, and so as of right now, I have not seen Donald Trump actually reference it in any way. He hasn't condemned the video, or I should say videos, because this guy has made many videos of Trump going on killing sprees against his political opponents. And so I guess, are you surprised? I mean, he's found time to endorse a book, tell people to vote for Sean Spicer on Dancing with the Stars. He's tweeted any number of times. He's been on Twitter, but hasn't found time to tweet about this.
You know, if I'm just trying to realistically assess how they would handle the situation, I would hope that they probably just didn't tell him about it, because then there's the risk of him trying to retweet it or share it or something like that. I don't think he would actually find an issue with it. I think he would find it funny. So there's been plenty of other grotesque things. And this isn't quite as violent, but you might remember when he shared the video of him body slamming the CNN logo from, you know, somebody that superimposed it over wrestling. So he's found things like this and shared things like this before. I don't know if this would cross the threshold for him as something he wouldn't touch, but my guess is they probably just kept it away from him.
Yeah. Well, while he hasn't touched this, he did touch one thing, and so I want to turn to that as our last topic. We know that Donald Trump hated Shep Smith. It was one of the main concerns that Trump appeared to have about Fox News not being sufficiently loyal towards him and his movement. And now, as of just last week, Shep Smith is moseying on down that dusty trail. And so I'm curious, as someone who spends a lot of time paying attention to Fox News, do you think that this is the end? Is this all they needed to do to reassure the president? Or, you know, is a different head going to be on the chopping block at some point?
And this was clearly the last vestige of the news division for Fox. They've relied on Shep Smith, and they pointed to Shep Smith for months, if not years, as the example of Fox's news division and how there was a firewall between the news division and the opinion side. And that's gone now. You have nothing. The closest you might get is Neil Cavuto, and he is just another cog in this propaganda machine. Shep was it. That's all they had. And he shows that there is no room in Fox News for someone who can present the facts and report the news. That's just not their business model. So yeah, it's an appeasement move by Trump. This comes as he is repeatedly attacking them and talking about how he wants to switch to OANN, how he needs to find a more supportive and better news outlet. This is really alarming because this is a network that's watched by millions of people every single night. And now you have no news reporting at all whatsoever. You just have pure opinion across the board.
One more question for you. I'm curious, what about Chris Wallace? I mean, Trump has complained about him before, and actually, you know, between Shep leaving and today, he had a couple of tweets about how he was, you know, nothing compared to his father and all of that. Do you think that Chris Wallace, who is, I would say, less regularly critical of Trump than Shep was, but does occasionally acknowledge reality, is there a place for him at Fox News?
Well, Chris Wallace, we found at Media Matters, Chris Wallace won't even go on most of the other shows. Mm-hmm. The one show he felt comfortable with appearing on outside of his own, you know, Sunday show was Shep's, and that's gone. And we tracked, you know, the past year, he has really diminished his appearances on other shows. I think he's got a problem with the opinion side, and he won't go on the shows anymore. So now you're going to have people who won't have any access. If they're pure Fox viewers, they won't have any access to objective news reporting anymore.
That's interesting. I actually did not know that he had changed his sort of guest habits. So thank you for adding that. Jordan Ewell, as always, love to have you on. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me, John.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, congressional candidate joins us on the other side. In Oregon's 3rd District, you have an incumbent Democrat. This is Earl Blumenauer, who has held that seat since 1996. That is a long time. Back during the run of Seinfeld, actually. And so, what does it take to take down an incumbent who's been around for that long? Well, we're joined by someone who hopes to do exactly that. Albert Lee, congressional candidate, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Jake, thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So tell me about, like I said in the intro, Earl Blumenauer has been around for a long time. What about this time and about his record makes it so that you want to run against him now?
Well, first of all, it's not about Earl, it's about our future. Mm-hmm. You know, my name's Albert Lee. I'm running to represent the people of the 3rd District of Oregon to the United States Congress. I'm running, first of all, because democracy requires choice, something we haven't had here in over a generation. I'm running because we have and face a series of crises here in this district, across the country, and around the world that require bold action now, and not just the inspirational and aspirational words. Also, I'm running because I believe in the basic tenets of the Democratic Party when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's beyond time that we uplift some new voices from other perspectives, from other lived experiences to represent us here in the most diverse district of the state. Now, above all of that, I'm running because I believe that it's time that we end this oligarchy of career multimillionaire politicians ruling over us and have true representatives of the people by citizen representatives who know the struggle.
So you said there that you want to actually represent the people, and you mentioned crises. What are some of the crises that you feel like Blumenauer is not representing the people of his district in regards to?
Absolutely. So one of the first things that when we talk to people on the doors is the homelessness crisis. It's exploded over this last generation. It's a crisis that started off very small in the downtown area, and now it covers the entire district. We talk about, in addition to that, the lack of affordable housing and living wages that places too many of us into the struggling class. And then above all of those issues are our climate emergency. We have less than 8 to 11 years to do something, anything to solve that. And if we don't do that, then none of the other issues will really matter.
I certainly agree in the idea of having a house that would be ready and willing to do something in regards to that if we got the right president in 2020, would be nice.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you too about, so you're running in this race. You are also a member of the DSA, which is a group that thankfully over the past year or so, people have heard a lot more about. It hadn't previously been something talked about too much nationally. What does being a member of the DSA bring to your race?
I'll tell you what, a lot of power. The DSA here, the local chapter of the Portland DSA, is an incredibly vibrant and an amazing organization. I was just at the monthly meeting the other day. We had over 300 people there. People are fired up. They are tired of looking at the situation and saying there's nothing that can be done. We need to have a government that fights for the people, that works for the people, and not just for the wealthy few. And the DSA is all about that.
You know, I'm curious too. I know, you know, a good bit about the DSA here in California, in Oregon, less so. I know that Oregon is a state that has, you know, some areas that are quite liberal, but then also has some rural areas that are pretty conservative. In regards to your race, what is having that affiliation? What effect does that have when you're talking to people? Are they open to democratic socialism? Are they questioning of it?
Absolutely. No, they are quite open to it. We're here in the third district. We are a plus 24 Democrat on the Cook Voting Partisan Index. So that means that there's no Republican, no third party candidate will ever have a shot at winning in this district. It's a heavily Democratic district. And I would argue that we are one of the most progressive districts in the country. And that's sort of what I'm gambling on. I'm saying, hey, we have a neoliberal centrist Democrat that has basically put on the cloak of progressivism in the past and has built up a decent brand, made in China plastic bicycles that'll end up in the ocean. He puts those pins on everyone. But the reality is when you just scratch the surface, it's not enough. We need somebody that's gonna actually truly fight for the people.
And so in that district that, as you're pointing out, is incredibly blue, Blumenauer on, you know, one of the most high profile progressive priorities, passing Medicare for all, he's currently against it and receives money, by the way, from the healthcare industry. And so we're always curious when we have a candidate on, especially for the first time, what is your philosophy on raising money for your candidacy?
Yeah, no corporate money whatsoever. We are endorsed by Brand New Congress, as well as the Portland chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, as well as the local chapter of Our Revolution, the Independent Progressives for Action. And it is absolutely important that we do not take any corporate contributions. I think that taint is one of the biggest problems that we have. It's not just the right side of the aisle. We have folks on the left side of the aisle that take so much money from corporations. And that's why we have, like, what is it, a 4% approval rating in Congress? Because those folks don't work for us. They work for the people that pay them.
And where can people watching this find out more information about your candidacy and your platform?
Absolutely. We have albertlee2020.com, as well as our Twitter and Facebook and Instagram pages.
Okay. Albert Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a short break. We come back. Another guest, an author, is going to join us in studio to provide a defense of elitism with a comedic twist after this. Pay attention to politics, you probably hear a lot about the elites. Obviously, there's a lot of popular resentment towards the elites on both sides of the aisle. Donald Trump, who is just about the definition of an elite, he actually calls them out quite frequently. What are we supposed to make of all this? We're joined now by author Joel Stein, author of In Defense of Elitism, Why I'm Better Than You and You Are Better Than Someone Who Didn't Buy This Book, which gives you an idea right off the bat that this is a comedic take on this topic. But I'm interested in finding out about the elites and the populace.
Yeah, it's not a parody. In defense of elitism, I really do want to defend the elites. I want to defend expertise.
Define that.
Well, first of all, I'm talking about expertise. There's been a lot of talk about operating from your gut, and we've elected someone with no experience as our president, and I think that has not worked out very well. So I'm defending expertise. I think there's two kinds of elite. When you say Donald Trump is a member of the elite,
I mean financial and in terms of
yes,
political connections.
And that's not, I define the elite as the intellectual elite. These are people who are much hated, but they're probably at Davos, and they're not all rich, right? Some of them work for NGOs, which is the elite word for charities. Mm-hmm. Some of them work in academia, government. These aren't necessarily the highest paid jobs.
Okay.
And then there's a different kind of elite, which I, in the book, call the boat elite. Mm-hmm. And they're, because Trump makes this amazing speech in Minneapolis last year, mm-hmm. where he suddenly out of nowhere says, after railing against the elite in the entire campaign, and the Republicans have been doing that for a very long time, mm-hmm. he suddenly says, why are they the elite? Like, we have bigger houses, we mm-hmm. have boats. And I was like, oh, right, they're the boat elite.
And he thinks that, that's true, not just of himself, but the people in the audience.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
amazing that he can go back and forth, he could do that. And then say we're going to stand against the elite, and then he could do it again, and they would cheer the whole
well,
time.
Well, I think he's parsing this difference, and in fact, mm-hmm. in subsequent speeches, he tried to say they're the elite and we're the super elite because mm-hmm. he only knows like four words.
That's true.
But they're different. They believe in different things. They believe in money, whereas we believe in ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's this battle taking place. What Vilfredo Pareto wrote this. He was this mm-hmm. Italian economist, wrote this piece in 1900. The fascists loved this dude. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this piece called The Circulation of Elites. And he said there's a battle between two elites. It's like Orwell, Animal Farm. Mm-hmm. Someone's always going to be ruling. Someone's going to be thrown out. And I feel like we're in a moment, we're in a fight between the Steve Bannons, the nationalists, the isolationists, the people who are real tribalists versus mm-hmm. the intellectual globalists who believe in expertise. And mm-hmm. and somebody's gonna win and somebody's gonna get their, DC is gonna either be full of farm to table restaurants or steak restaurants. Mm-hmm. We don't know how it's gonna go right now.
But to find out how it might go, you went to a couple different places.
Yes. And I
wanna find out about each of them. So one involved going to, I think you worded it as it's the most Trump supporting county in America?
Yeah, numerically, I went to the county that had the highest percentage of Trump voters
okay.
in the country, which is Roberts County. It's in the panhandle of Texas near mm-hmm. Oklahoma. I went to the only town in that county. It's a very rural county. It's called Miami, mm-hmm. spelled Miami. And I spent a week there with people just trying to find out what they think of coastal elites. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised. I went there after reading Hillbilly Elegy and having very little experience in rural America, I expected like opioid addicted, toothless mamas who didn't watch the news. And this county is full of, most of the people went to college. Mm-hmm. Most of the people there were better off than the average people in LA. And they were very thoughtful and very nice. They were very Christian, they were very white. Mm-hmm. But I thought I would go there and I would learn from them and they would learn from me, but what I would learn from them, you could stitch on a doily. But instead, I really learned mm-hmm. how they feel and why they felt comfortable voting for Trump, even though yeah. Trump is so much disliked them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you point out, obviously, they're very Christian and obviously very conservative, mm-hmm. but I think you said that you actually found them to be less dogmatic in their beliefs than some sort of bastions of liberalism that are generally thought of as more cosmopolitan and open-minded.
Yeah, they definitely knew more about our lives than we do about theirs because mm-hmm. they own televisions. They see
That's
our lives
true.
Represented everywhere and they travel. Mm-hmm. And they're likely to travel somewhere where people travel, which is where yeah. we are likely to live, whereas we don't travel to Miami, Texas that often
yeah.
and see their world. So and they feel correctly a loss of power over the last 10, 15 years. And even though white Christians still the most powerful bloc in America, less so than 10 years ago. When you feel acceleration more than speed.
Yeah.
And so they are freaked out and panicked, and they're willing to go with a guy who they would never want to hang out with, mm-hmm. Donald Trump, if he's going to help them keep their power.
Yeah. The way I usually heard it said is that people react in this sort of knee-jerk way based on relative deprivation, not an absolute deprivation. It's not that they're bone poor.
No.
It's that they're less powerful than they once were.
Well, that's why I wrote a book that's funny, or tries to be funny, which is that I always assumed growing up that if we were going to have a moment of nationalism, of authoritarianism, it mm-hmm. was going to be because there was an economic collapse, there was a war, there was a natural disaster. And instead, it's like this unforced error. Mm-hmm. Things couldn't be going better in the world. Mm-hmm. And yet, country after country is falling into this scary nationalist trap.
Okay.
And I think we just need to back off and kind of examine this and decide if this is what we really want.
Okay, and so you went to Miami, yep. But you also was it in LA or was it in San Francisco? The Stephanie Miller Resistance dinner parties.
It's
that you went
not
to.
Just in LA, it's four houses from mine.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah, so Stephanie is a.
So a host and comedian. I've actually been to her shows before.
Yeah, I did it yesterday morning.
Well,
it's really easy. I don't even have to take a shower. I just walk four houses down.
That's true. There you go. And people like Nancy Pelosi, Maxine Waters, Ted Lieu, Adam Schiff were there. So what about that sort of group? How do they contrast with Miami?
I remember being at one of Stephanie's resistance dinner parties with like Rob Reiner and Moby and Malcolm Nance right after the election. And they were talking about the Russian tapes and how impeachment was coming and how people were tricked into voting for Trump. Mm-hmm. And they were already discussing like how they're going to deal with President Pence. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, they are not really in touch. Like people voted for this guy knowing what they were getting. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to get thrown out. And he's not even our problem. There's a populist wave reaching out over the whole world. And if you get rid of Trump, you can just get a smarter version of Trump. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just get rid of this one guy. I want to solve this problem that we're facing.
Well, I don't want to spoil the book, but do you have a general version of what that solution might be like?
Well, one conclusion I come to at the end of the book.
I'm a solutions person. I want to know what I should be doing. Okay. I try to be.
Yeah. Well, what I was trying to solve for is why people hate the elites and how we can kind of get that back. Mm-hmm. And I really felt it the night of the election. I went to Stephanie's house the night of the election, and I brought a bottle of sparkling Trump wine from Virginia. And I thought we'd open it and like toast his failure with his sad attempt to be an elitist with this sparkling wine. Never got to open it, just got freaked out. Like I don't think I've been that freaked out as I did that night. Because I knew, I mean, Republicans have won before and I haven't been freaked out, but this felt so different.
Yeah.
This felt like a real burn it down rejection of expertise. So the conclusion I come to is something people have been saying to me since I've been 6 years old that I kind of ignored, which was drop the smugness. Like if I could just project some humility, if I could stop thinking like, if these people in the middle of the country would just be informed and vote for their own interests, this would never happen. Mm. Like it's that attitude, I think, that makes people not listen to us and not value expertise. So I know I probably have failed here today, but this is probably better than I would normally have done. Uh-huh. I'm trying to scale back the smugness.
Okay. I could probably try to do that as well. And I think generally, I don't know where this fits into your dichotomy, but media elites, commentators, and pundits, way more smugness than is ever earned by these individuals, including myself.
And the thing is, you get asked to talk about things. I remember going on like the Bill Maher show and being given your stack of information to talk about that day and seeing that, oh, we're talking about the telecommunications bill. Mm-hmm. Like, I should not be talking about the telecommunications bill. So knowing that you're not,
your
expertise is limited and don't expand it everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. It should be like grad school. As you learn more, you should know what you don't know. And you should acknowledge your ignorance.
More of that.
So In Defense of Elitism is the book, Joel Stein. It's fascinating. And I definitely think considering the political place, the social place we find ourselves in, very important that people familiarize themselves. So thank you.
All right, call yourself an elitist from now on and I'll be happy.
Okay, I'll work on that. I'll put it on my Chiron, actually.
That's what I want.
Yeah, there you go. We're gonna take one last break. We come back. AOC finally weighs in on the primary, although perhaps not in the way you might have expected after this. So far in this primary process, AOC has been mostly hands off for, you know, this big up and comer, one of the most high profile Democratic politicians, especially on social media. She hasn't really weighed in yet. And I don't expect that in general, in terms of endorsing, she'll do that soon. But she did weigh in. She came out and she threw some punches. But in response to one of the primary contenders on the Democratic side throwing punches of his own. And so this was Pete Buttigieg. So in the days leading up to this debate, which is coming later tonight, he decided to attack a couple of the different candidates. And the first is Elizabeth Warren. So he criticized her on her fundraising strategy of, at the very least now, focusing on small dollar donations, and said, we're not going to beat Trump with pocket change. And so this is a criticism that she has faced now that she has apparently made clear, although we'll see about raising money only from those sorts of donors during the general election. A lot of the, you know, normal like do things the way they've always done, Democrats are saying, no, you need to raise as much money from as many billionaires as possible during the general election. That is the only way you will be able to contend with how much money Trump will raise. And Pete Buttigieg appears to be one of those people. That argument sort of falls apart when you realize that he didn't raise nearly as much money as the two candidates who did focus on the pocket change. He got beat by the pocket change. But on top of that, before we get to the response, it wasn't just Warren. He's going out there swinging. So against O'Rourke, O'Rourke made news recently for implying that churches' tax exempt status could be taken away if they discriminate based on sexuality and these sorts of things. And so to that, Pete Buttigieg said, I get it. He needs to pick a fight in order to stay relevant, which is not just a disagreement, but a fairly condescending one there. And look, Buttigieg is polling better than Beto O'Rourke. I guess they're both trailing the front runners by a significant amount. And it's funny to say that O'Rourke is only doing this to stay relevant as Pete Buttigieg is attacking the other candidates to stay relevant. But you know what? Projection's a big thing, very popular these days. And so he's attacking both of them. AOC steps in and defends both Warren and O'Rourke, saying first, small dollar grassroots campaigns, aka what Buttigieg insults here as pocket change, outfundraise him by millions. Our nation's leaders should be working to end the era of big money politics, not protect it. And Beto's gun policy isn't picking a fight, it's taking a stand. Now, this is not AOC endorsing these candidates. It would be ridiculous if she endorsed two. And I've seen nothing to imply, especially in the case of O'Rourke, that she's likely to endorse him. But she does feel like she needs to stand for her values. And in this case, I mean, you might think that Beto went too far, and perhaps he did. He does sometimes. He likes to get like in the moment in these little debates and stuff. But it's not like many of these stances are coming out of nowhere when it comes to gun violence, for instance, when it comes to these sorts of things. This is something that he's been talking about for a long time for all of his other problems. And so for Pete Buttigieg to attack him in that way, to imply that it's just some new development, a last minute Hail Mary, that's fairly ridiculous. And for someone like Pete Buttigieg, who has not done the work over the course of years to really like solidify any sense of like earned respect in the Democratic electorate, I don't think you're talking from a position of strength when you attack these better known candidates. And so Beto also responded saying, Pete can belittle the grassroots, he can call buybacks a shiny object, he can say whatever he wants, but guns kill 40,000 people each year. These people deserve action, I'll be fighting for them. And so look, he comes off looking bad in comparison to Beto O'Rourke on the guns issue, obviously. And these are the sorts of things that make people question Buttigieg. It's the fact that he likes to like get this idea that he's like this young Kennedy, he's this young mayor or whatever, charismatic, has a lot of skills, plays the piano. And yet when it comes to actually taking a strong stance on the issues that people care about, not only does he not do that, but he belittles the politicians who do. Which is a bad look in a primary with as many people, especially as many people doing better than he is at present. And again, a reminder, in terms of him belittling the idea that we should get big money out of politics, he's raised $32 million so far through the course of this entire primary, evenly split between small and large contributions. Both Sanders and Warren raised more than Buttigieg in the third quarter of 2019. That's 25 and 24 million to his 19 million. And they got theirs almost universally, far more, especially Bernie, from small dollar donations. So look, you can have fears about the general election or whatever. He's a centrist. He's going to have those fears. He falls into that sort of groupthink. But attacking the people who have successfully rallied hundreds of thousands and a million people in the case of Bernie Sanders to donate to his campaign is not just belittling the candidates, it's belittling the people who make up that movement. And since you're desperate to get those people to support you, that is indeed a bizarre strategy for Pete Buttigieg to take right now. But it's not just the Democratic primary contenders that AOC has been attacking, rightfully so. She also criticized the president. So she had been tweeted at her, I'll say it, AOC's frequent crying only reinforces the stereotype that women are too emotional for politics. This is over her trips to the border, her talking about climate change. These are some of the most important crises that face us. Her being criticized for that seems a bit bizarre. And so she responded saying, Trump sexually assaults women, impulsively allows Kurds to be murdered, boosts videos of shooting journalists. The GOP says, aha, letting your voice shake after seeing firsthand human rights violations at the border and understanding climate stakes makes women too emotional for politics. This is why I wish that she could be in the primary, because she does not back down from any fight. And she communicates perhaps better than any other politician in this country in terms of understanding her values, understanding how they apply to politics, and then understanding how you communicate about the linkage between those two things. And she can do that against critics on the right. She can do that against Democrats running in the primary. She can handle all those fights while also putting forward a bold proposal of her own, including her anti-poverty program that we broke down just a couple of weeks ago on the show. There's more that I wish we could have gotten to, but that's probably gonna do it for now. We're about out of time. I wanted to read some of your reviews. If you have been reviewing us on iTunes, I really appreciate that. If you haven't, it's probably about time. Feel free to. Later on tonight, by the way, we're gonna be doing live debate coverage. So that's gonna be a lot of fun. And if not there, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.